You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to Table Talk, a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stefan Gates, a food science writer, broadcaster, and gastronaut. Today, we're talking about the role that nutrition has in helping people recover from COVID, especially if they've been treated in ICU. Since the pandemic started, over 450,000 people have been admitted to hospital with COVID-19 in the UK. And at the peak of the second wave, more than 1,000 people a day were on ventilators. But once you're out of hospital, what can you be eating to help recover? With me today are Dr. Ricardo Caccialanza, Head of Clinical Nutrition and the Dietetics Unit at Policlinico San Matteo. Hello there, Ricardo.
Hello, nice to meet you. Thank you.
And we've got Shane McAuliffe, the Science and Digital Communications Lead at NedPro, the Global Centre for Nutrition and Health. Hi, Shane.
Hi, Stefan. Thanks for having me.
Nah, no problem at all. Now, Shane, what is the current nutritional advice that's been given to COVID patients when they leave ICU?
Yes, so I think it's important to say that now we're probably looking at a situation where more people are recovering from COVID-19 illness rather than being actively treated. We know that the worst affected by COVID have been the elderly and those with chronic diseases, and that those are also tend to be the groups who are most at risk of malnutrition in society. So the reality is that we're having lots of vulnerable people arriving back onto hospital wards and also into the community. And I think that we can look at nutrition as a modifiable risk factor for these patients. So if we think of people being discharged home, certainly, I think that there have been a number of good resources put together. At NedPro, we've aimed to do this throughout the pandemic on our dedicated microsite. And something that's been developed by a number of UK nutrition agencies has been something called the COVID-19 malnutrition pathway. This is something that I've used regularly with my own patients. I'm a registered dietitian by day, working in the NHS. And this is something I think can be useful for other healthcare practitioners and also even GPs for those who are arriving home. So the way they've set it up, it's really accessible. It's in the form of a traffic light system. And the way this works is the green leaflet is advice for those who are needing to or aiming to eat well, both during and after COVID-19 illness. So these tend to be general recommendations for, you know, the fundamentals of good nutrition, which are eating from a diversity of plant foods, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts and seeds. We've healthy fats from things like olive oil, nuts and fish oil, and adequate protein from a mix of meat, fish, eggs, dairy, and some plant-based sources as well. Now, I think I mentioned that we have people nutritionally vulnerable, and this is where the advice tends to change a little bit as we certainly, as we step down from the ICU and also as people who return home. So the next stage in the traffic light system is amber, and that's those who are considered at risk of malnutrition. This might be those with a reduced appetite or perhaps those who've lost weight without meaning to, whether that's in hospital or whether that's at home. The focus here shifts a little bit to foods that are higher in protein and higher in calories. And often with a reduced appetite, what we'd advise is breaking this down into small regular portions throughout the day. So whether that's three small meals with little snacks in between. And within these smaller meals and snacks, we look to add value to everything we eat or do something called food fortification. And this is adding calorie dense extras, things like milk, cheese, butter, example, to meals, and also using nourishing fluids for things like milk smoothies and soups. Now, the last stage of
That one sounds like it's really sort of throwing calories at the problem. Is that an oversimplification?
Well, I think, as I said, if we're looking at people who have depleted body mass or who've lost weight and really have a reduced appetite, secondary to illness or secondary to step down, then it's trying to minimize losses is the aim. Now, lots of those food I've mentioned, they're not just high in calories, but they're also high in protein, which we know is particularly important for preserving muscle mass, for example. And I think the last stage of this ladder, or this traffic light system, is those considered at high risk, or the red category. They get the same advice I've talked through with the fundamentals and the advice for making the most of what they're eating. But in addition, many of these patients will also have been given nutrition supplement drinks, or what we call oral nutritional supplements. Now, these have extra energy, extra protein, and vitamins and minerals as well for those who can't get enough from their food. And these can be particularly helpful to rebuild strength and also regain weight.
Now, what effect do you think this is having? Is enough being done to help patients once they leave? Are they using that advice, and are they putting it into practice, do you think?
I hope so. As I said, my experience as a dietitian who's worked on a number of COVID wards during the course of the pandemic has been to try and catch these patients as they're passing through our system and make sure that they're well equipped and ready to go home with the right information and to start employing some of these tactics. Now, I do think that the realities of service pressures in hospitals during the pandemic has meant maybe nutrition screening and, you know, with things like staff shortages and just enormous pressure on the NHS, perhaps there are some people who slipped through the cracks, which I think this is why we need to ensure that those who are making it home, that we're getting this information to, you know, GPs, primary care physicians, and also healthcare staff in general, anyone in patient-facing roles, so that they know some advice to give and also where to direct people for the right information.
I see the problem that I always find with people in the UK is that they have this information. You know, the first stage of what you said, the green level, is relatively generic advice, but people in the UK just don't seem to take it very well, do they? You know, we don't have a fantastic nutritional profile of the foods that we eat already. Is your advice actually having an effect, or does there need to be another level of follow-up? Is that what you're saying, that there needs to be more help with nutrition after people have left hospital?
I think so. And I think probably more recognition of the important role that nutrition plays in helping us to put our best foot forward, whether that is in terms of preventing vulnerability to illness in the first place, or whether that's you know, promoting good recovery when we get home. I think that the reality is that a lot of these aren't new challenges. You're right, but I think what COVID has done is it's brought a lot of them to the fore. And I think what we have now is an advantage of a captive audience, both in the public and in healthcare. And it gives us an opportunity to promote a culture, whether that's population behavior change, whether it's healthcare professionals putting this stuff into routine practice, or whether it's, you know, the government to look at some of the root causes of those who are vulnerable to poor nutrition and start to put measures in place to tackle this.
Okay, Ricardo, let's dig a little bit deeper into the connection between nutrition and COVID-19. What level of effect can different nutritional profiles of food that people are eating have on their recovery once they've left?
Well, it's very difficult to say, because there are not studies at the moment which properly assess this topic. And going back to the what you were saying about UK and nutrition, unfortunately, I have to admit that generally speaking, nutritional science, clinical nutritional sciences, are overlooked. In Italy, for example, we have there are not so many clinical nutrition units in the hospitals, and people are forced to be alone from many aspects, which can be fundamental, not only for prevention, but also for recovery. So I'm not as optimistic as Shane was. I think that the key point to have a proper recovery is to be able to receive a proper nutritional consultation. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise people are left alone, they are not motivated, and they take, you know, nutrition just like, you know, eating something with the family and with people and going, now you can go, are not able yet to go to the restaurant and having fun. And there is a gap on the awareness of the importance of nutrition. From COVID-19 pandemic is an example of this concept. We have been reading papers which describe that obese people are at highest risk of death and ICU admission, but no one is really acting to do something concrete against obesity. We have some, you know, educational programs, but which are not enough. Mm. People need to be followed up. And maybe the digital technologies, for example, we are using now, could be a good example to do something more deeply and more widespread among the population. Then we have been studying some interesting point in the ICU, and we have just published a paper which shows that the early caloric deficit in ICU for mechanically ventilated patients is an independent prognostic factor. But still, in the ICU, in many ICUs, the nutritional issues are still overlooked. Mm-hmm. You give the same protocol, you use the same protocol, try to give the same enteral formula to all the patients because you don't have time to treat with aspect. There are some good examples when you have dietitian in the ICU wards, and these are the ICU wards which perform better and which deal with these aspects much better and have the better results. On the other hand, we have been finishing our NutriCovid multicenter Italian studies, and among the nutritional parameters, the prognostic factors, reduced food intakes in the days before admission and in the days, in the 3-4 days after admission, is the most powerful prognostic factor from the nutritional point of view. So there are many, many aspects which really deserve more investments and more studies.
We have does this crucial period make a difference between whether or not somebody will suffer the onset of something like long COVID, or does it affect the length of the recovery period? I know that you say that there's no real research, but in your view of what you've seen so far.
In my view, the hospital admission could be a crucial point, not only for COVID, but also for cancer patients, for generally speaking, patients at nutritional risk. If during hospital admission, you are able to start the early recovery plan and you are provided with the right amount of calories and proteins, I'm convinced that your immediate functional status once you are discharged and your quality of life in the early phases of recovery would definitely be better. You can speed up the recovery process if you have a good start during hospitalization in the critical phases of the disease, where the phases in which you lose more weight, you lose more muscle. Mm. If someone is able to counteract this process, definitely patients could be treated better with more successful outcomes.
And Ricardo, is there a simple connection between muscle wasting and eating more protein to solve that problem? Is it as simple as that?
No, it's not enough. Muscle function works if the muscle is used. So it's not if you stay in bed and you just eat meat, eggs, and fish, you are going to waste muscle. You have to move. So the recovery plans should include physiotherapy, should include physical activity according to individual tolerance. But muscle function, muscle mass needs to be needs to be treated with the combination of the right amount of nutrition and the right and tailored amount of physical activity.
Mm. And this all comes back to medical resources, really, I suppose, doesn't it? Now, Shane, when if we can be specific about a couple of the issues, when people have been struggling with breathing, how does this impact the food that they can eat? I mean, they may have been on ventilation, for instance. Does that change how people can intake food?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think most definitely. If we talk about patients perhaps who've been on ventilators in hospital, then we know that when they're taken off a ventilator, often we can run into issues with things like difficult swallow function. And I think Ricardo mentioned the importance of having a multidisciplinary team approach in the hospital where dietitians will be there for nutrition, where physios will be there to help get people moving. And that's where we'd also employ speech and language therapists, for example, mm-hmm. who are experts in swallow and can advise around, for example, modified textures or consistencies or even thickness of fluids. So I think having lots of different inputs from different professionals is really, really important in that sense.
And is there the availability of the care? And, you know, do we have the resources, or is it a question of a changing attitudes?
Possibly a bit of both. I would say that obviously some of the things we've mentioned during the course of the pandemic means that resources have been running thin. There's been issues with things like redeployment. At the start, there were issues with, I suppose, lots of unknowns and perhaps concerns around safety and PPE, etc. But as I said, I think what this does now is gives us an opportunity to use the pandemic as a case in point and start to think about how effective care was delivered and how we can make sure that this is repeated going forward.
Okay. Now, Ricardo, from a nutritional point of view, can you compare COVID yet? I know, and again, we're waiting for research, really, but can you compare it with other viruses and the nutritional impact of how quickly people recover?
Difficult to say. I don't, well, data are lacking. I can't compare with the other virus in general. It's similar to RDS, but it's a pandemic. It's the COVID-19 is not just one single kind of the disease, because it depends on the severity. So we have mild patients, which, you know, can be compared to, you know, something like a general infection, like a flu, when they are a bit, you know, they're older and they're a bit fragile. And it's different, completely different setting when you talk about ICU patients. Mm-hmm. So for the mildest forms of COVID, recovery generally is quick and what we are learning from COVID is that every patient is a different world, is a different if the virus is the same, your reaction is very different. Mm-hmm. So we have very severe cases with long COVID and what is a bit surprising is that we still have to understand what are the criteria which impair the recovery phases, which is not just the age. It's something like immunological, but which is still unknown, because we have young patients, fit patients, sporty people in ICU, almost dead, who lost kilograms of muscle mass and recovery in months. Mm. And then you have elderly people with the severe COVID forms, but thanks to their immunological memories and these aspects which are not codified, they recover, they get out of the hospital, and in a few weeks they go back to their normal life. So very difficult also from the scientific point of view, if we want to design studies to assess these aspects, We have to think of immunological profiles or data which we are not used to adopt and to consider for these kinds of data, of results, evidence we want to collect.
And that's on top of the fact that nutritional data are very difficult to collect anyway. You know, to run nutritional studies is immensely complex already. And then you've got a complexity of a disease with different levels of impact.
Yeah, from my point of view, it's the most fashionable and interesting field of science because it's complex and we have to take into account so many variables and so many psychological aspects, social aspects.
Yeah, so and we're still in the middle of the pandemic as well. It's difficult to step back and take a view, isn't it? Okay, Shane, let's think about this on a broader level. Do you think that nutritional advice is treated seriously enough in medicine?
I think, I mean, based on our discussions today, we've certainly seen that maybe there's an underemphasis on nutrition across healthcare practice more generally. I know that this is something we've been aiming to tackle with NEDPRO, or initially the Need for Nutrition Education Project, as the acronym suggests. And I think what we've found is that there's definitely not enough attention paid to nutrition from the very beginning. So right the way through medical training, for example. And to put this in context, I'd just point to a piece of work that was published from our group last year in the British Medical Journal named Time for Nutrition. And this highlighted, on the first hand, a need for more nutrition within medical education, but also a desire for it. So what this was a survey of medical students and doctors about their experiences of nutrition, both in education and in their practice as well. There were over 850 participants, and I think the overarching message that we got was that a majority felt their nutrition training was inadequate. So almost three quarters had received less than 2 hours of education in the previous 12 months. Mm-hmm. And I mean, overall, that meant that almost three quarters didn't feel confident talking to their patients about nutrition and did so, you know, once a month or less. Now, on the other side of that, we saw that near 100% of the doctors and students we spoke to recognized that nutrition was important for good health, and a majority said that they would like to receive more training on nutrition as part of their training as well. So I think it suggests that, yes, maybe the perceived importance, at least in students and some junior doctors, is high, but they feel that they're not equipped well enough to translate this into practice. And this isn't just the UK, but this is across, or well documented in Australia and in the US as well.
Mm. Ricardo, your nutrition is presumably your life, really. Does it frustrate you that it's not treated seriously enough in medicine? When you were an undergrad at med school, did you learn enough about nutrition, do you think?
Well, luckily, more than frustrating me, it stimulates me. So we have so many motivations, and now in Italy, we have the same problems. Australia, UK, US, and Italy, and Europe. And unfortunately, we still have a lot to do to make administrators and other colleagues understand the potential and the fantastic improvement we could provide to patients with correct nutritional approach and early approach. During my courses, I did not receive enough nutrition education, certainly. I specialized in nutrition. I also traveled a bit. I went to UK to deal with eating disorders and to start to have a research approach. We are working particularly in the field of oncology in Italy. We are trying to focus the attention on nutrition in oncology. And in the last 5 years, we have put together the main scientific societies. And now we have a proper working group within the Ministry of Health. So it could be frustrating, it's tiring, it's stressful. but it's much more stimulating. So I invite all colleagues to try to join with nutrition experts and to try to, because nutrition can be also very simple and it's very cheap. We can have, it's the most effective and cost-effective treatment you can give to patients. Mm. You just, it's complex because, you know, it's talking about education, habits, marketing, there are lots of pressure from the industries. So it's very, it's difficult, but it's difficult to find a colleague. We are improving the treatment tolerance to cancer patients during radiotherapy or chemotherapy after surgical intervention. And all the doctors, all the colleagues are happy about that. You are not you're not annoying anyone. You're just providing education, right prescriptions, and you are taking care of patients who after discharge can come to your hospital outpatient clinic and try, you know, to follow up and to improve in the months their nutritional status. It's a fantastic opportunity, not only for us, but for the entire medical community. So it's frustrating, can be frustrating because you have to, it's something like you have to sell something to others. Yeah. Which is not. But it's so important that it's really motivation can increase. And so I'm very happy to be able to now to direct this clinic and to have the opportunity to work with so many people around Italy and hopefully also around the world soon.
That's a very positive spin on that. I like that. It's very good. Now, Shane, we know that COVID disproportionately affects those who are obese or have diabetes. But is there also a sort of socioeconomic variability? Does it relate to the postcode lottery of healthcare as well? And are outcomes worse for people in lower income groups?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that's a really good point. We know, as Ricardo outlined earlier, that there are some physiological explanations why, say, people living with obesity or some chronic diseases may have worse outcomes from COVID-19. We know that. And I think it has been interesting to see COVID being promoted as a call to action of sorts for people to start, you know, taking responsibility and improving their own health. And I think that's been evident in the recent UK government obesity strategy, for example. Now, we do know that nutrition can make a difference. And I think, you know, it's a positive step if people become more interested in their health. And as I said, we create awareness and that attention is very much welcome and we can work with it. But I do think, exactly as you've said, we need to be careful about the way this is portrayed. So, for example, we know that hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and ultimately deaths are disproportionately affecting lower socioeconomic groups. And we know that rates of obesity and chronic diseases are also higher in these groups. So those figures are quite closely aligned. In fact, I heard Martin Carragher on this podcast a couple of weeks back talking about some of these issues. So I think if we are going to take lessons from the pandemic, then we need to understand them in a wider context than just the provision of nutrition advice and start to look a little bit deeper at the root structural and societal causes of these associations as well.
Yeah. Okay. Now, at the start of this interview, Shane gave lots of information about what the nutritional advice that's being offered to people leaving ICU. Ricardo, would you go along with that? Is there anything else that you would add as a general nutritional principle? I know you said that it's very patient specific, but is there general nutritional advice that applies to everyone who's had COVID?
Well, I think Shane gave a very complete view of what correct nutrition, general nutrition could be. We have been studying some, for example, if you want to be less general, more specific, the influence of vitamin D deficiency, for example. Mm-hmm. And so, and we now know that almost 90% of admitted patients had and are having vitamin D deficiency. So it's we are still waiting for more robust data. We are studying, but the evidence is we still don't know if there is a strong connection between the severity of the disease. But what we know is that vitamin D is like, has a crucial role for many other disease prevention, for many other biological aspects, not just bone health, but also immune function. So one general advice would be to take care of these aspects and to use fortified foods if they are available, or to take specific and tailored on the blood levels of vitamin D supplements. This could be a good suggestion, I think, because the data now are convincing. And if I'm not wrong, in UK there is a campaign to on the awareness of taking vitamin D supplements. Unfortunately, it's not the case in Italy, but generally, COVID and also these kind of diseases, which make more fragile people, should take into consideration. So, for example, the right amount of vitamins and minerals, which are unfortunately still overlooked, and with a general diet, even if it's a correct diet, it's very hard to reach the targets.
Mm-hmm. Which leads me on to my final question, really, for both of you, which is, what can be done to improve nutrition so that we're ready, God forbid, for the next pandemic, for another problem on this scale? Is it good that we now have more of an awareness of issues such as vitamin D deficiency, or is there something else? What else should we be looking at in order to prepare ourselves for the future? Ricardo, other than vitamin D, is there anything else that we should take away from what we've learned so far?
But generally speaking, we should finally be convinced as a whole system that nutrition can't be overlooked, even if it's something which is strictly connected with our social life. And we have this superficial attitude towards food, and we have, unfortunately, we have left too much in the hands of the industries, while it's something which should be taken care from a culture, more from a cultural, general cultural point of view. Mm-hmm. We need more education, which doesn't mean to make it boring or something like. But we really have to try to find a new balance between industry's interests and cultural interests and the health in the interests. Mm-hmm. And so it's something like a revolution which should start, and very difficult, because changing habits is a long process. But this pandemic is clearly showing what are the limits and what are the potential of treating these aspects in the right way.
Mm-hmm. And Shane, what do you think can be done in nutritional terms to prepare ourselves for the next pandemic, should there be one?
I think I like the word that Ricardo used, a nutrition revolution of sorts. And I think that in some ways, we can look at coming out of this period as an opportunity. And what we have the opportunity to do is make nutrition everyone's business. So I think that starts from the top. We discussed exploring some of the root causes of people who are nutritionally vulnerable. You mentioned socioeconomic conditions. We know that, for example, food access has been a big issue through the pandemic. If we look at figures coming out of groups like the Trussell Trust, for example. I think at the level of healthcare, we have an opportunity to put nutrition on the map and say that the patients we've been seeing who've been worst affected from COVID have disproportionately been those people who are also nutritionally vulnerable. So if we can really embed nutrition care into routine practice in healthcare, I think this is a good case in point for it. And then we have the population who, as we said, perhaps behavior change is something we can focus on. We need to support people in the immediate aftermath to promote their recovery, and particularly promote losses that have happened during COVID. So I think we've touched on some of those today. And on a wider level, we can emphasize the importance of good nutrition and the relationship it has with people's health. So I don't think we can pinpoint one thing here. I think we need a real whole systems approach if we're to really tackle this head on.
Yeah, and I guess we look forward to seeing more robust data on outcomes as well, which will help guide us all. Well, Shane McAuliffe and Dr. Ricardo Cacciolanza, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I think we've learned a huge amount. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts, in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from sustainable salmon to meat-free steaks. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thanks for listening.